Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Experience summer comfort for less. Explore our sale on curtains and bedding. Perfect time to update and freshen your home.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Liveline. You're going to think I'm telling fibs, but I'm not. I promise you, it was 40 years ago. This weekend, the weather pretty much exactly like it is today. And yet, the chances are you probably spent the entire day indoors, curtains pulled, watching the television and Live Aid. And since then, there is perhaps one image more than any other that you might associate with that day. All of the artists, well, not all, but nearly all of the artists gathered backstage. Brian Harris, good afternoon.
Hello, Philip. Good afternoon.
You took that photo.
Yeah, I did. Only just, I might add.
Only just. Okay, so is there a story?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, there is a story. We had no plans to do it. Logistically, it seemed almost impossible. But we wanted to try because we'd done it successfully with Band Aid. But it just wasn't happening. So I put some lights up in the VIP area where everyone was going for a drink. And I said to the assistant, you know, when we get enough faces in there, let me know. We'll put the lights on and see if we can get their attention and grab a group shot. Which is exactly what happened. You know, he said to me, look, almost everyone's in there, let's try. So I said, okay, I climbed up on the table with a camera and he switched the lights on and plunged the whole area into complete darkness. It was an absolutely horrifying moment of my life.
I mean, I stood there thinking, definitely your fault, Brian. It wasn't some other appliance that had tripped everything. It was your lights.
I'm afraid not. And I stood there in this complete sort of darkness thinking, I'm just going to become famous for being the guy that stopped the Live Aid performances around the world. Because everything was black, you know.
So hang on, so were you and thinking then, that the stage had gone black as well, that it wasn't just the backstage?
Because we were so close to the stage at the back in the VIP area, just behind the stage. Anyway, this guy suddenly pushed my leg at the bottom and said, you've got 5 minutes. And I looked down and I could barely see this chap. And he was standing with these two huge electrical gables and he plugged them in together and poof, up came the lights. And, to my amazement, you know, there in front of me was everybody. So we shouted and of course they all thought it was very funny. I think I only took 5 frames and then they got bored with the idiot up on the table and started to walk away.
Well, in fairness to them, it was very funny, Brian. I'm sorry, I know it must have been absolutely nerve-wracking for you. But hilarious for everybody else. Come here, when you're doing something like that, look, you are, this is not false flattery by any means, but you are a man who has taken pictures of people like Debbie Harry, Annie Lennox, David Bowie and so on, who, when I think of those people, it is your image, your pictures of them that I am thinking of. And so when it comes to doing something that is, I would imagine, as resistant to any kind of artistry as any shot is. Like, you're just basically herding cats getting people like that to look in your direction all at the same time. Had you any high concept in mind, anything that was going to elevate it, or were you just relying on the fame of all of these people to do that for you?
No, absolutely no high concept. It was purely, can we do this? Because it was so historic. And it would seem to me, you know, looking back, it would have been a tragedy not to have got a group shot of some kind. But you were never going to be able to make that a very artistic group shot. It was what it was. Mm. And, you know, that's fine. I mean, it's history, and I'm glad we managed to get that one frame. I had 5 frames, and I think just one frame where everybody was concentrating. George Michael and Andrew were in stitches, so they were just roaring their heads off. But bless Elton and Sting and everyone else, they were looking forward.
I am looking at the photo now. George Michael.
Oh, you've got it there, haven't you?
There's so much hair on display and not all of it on top of heads. A lot of unnecessary chest hair in that photograph. You were, as you say, present for history. Did it feel historic at the time or did it feel chaotic? Because, I mean, I'm thinking of things like, you know, Freddie Mercury's performance that day goes down in history as one of the most memorable musical performances anywhere ever. Were you there? Were you watching it? Did the chills run down your spine?
Absolutely not. I mean, one of the problems with being there that day and doing what I was doing, you know, I had a little studio set up backstage alongside Paula Yates, who's one of my great friends. She was doing interviews for American Network. And we would take, you know, David Bowie would go and talk to her and then come and have his picture taken and then go on stage. It was a bit like that, and it was chaotic. And
conveyor belts, yeah.
You could not leave that area and go on. So I saw none of the acts, barely heard them. Missed, obviously, the great performance by Freddie Mercury. And also missed the moment, which I think was significant, when David Bowie gave up that one song
for the video.
To show Michael Burke's film, which changed the dynamic of the entire day, you know. If you've seen that looking back and you've seen the documentary, you see the audience going from this rock and roll pop audience into one where they're looking in absolute shock and horror. Now, that was, I think it was one of the most significant moments of the entire concert.
Oh, look, it absolutely worked. My teenage self and my sister, sitting at home with the curtains pulled, as I said, hopped on the phone after that and pledged so much of our father's money that the poor man, all the colour drained from his face. You had, I suppose, gotten to see this project through and from various different perspectives, because you went to Ethiopia and you again created some incredibly memorable images.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing for me when Bob asked me to shoot the Band-Aid, recording and the Band-Aid group, none of us knew quite what was going to happen that day, and certainly no one could predict that success. But for me, it was ironic because I'd been with Save the Children Fund to Ethiopia in 1973, and my pictures were so horrific that when the magazines and newspapers here in the UK were very loath to print them, it was a horror story. And it looked, when I saw the Michael Burke film over a decade later, I was looking back to 73, it was exactly the same. History hadn't seemed to teach anybody anything. It was absolutely horrendous. Mm. So seeing it again brought back all those memories from 73. But I knew this time there was a great possibility that the newspapers and magazines and the media would pay attention, which was Bob's motive. And, of course, you can't say no to Bob.
That's a really special perspective, isn't it, Brian? Because so often life is messy, history is messy. You can't tie up all the ends of this very neatly, but you got to see that. And then you got to see the West responding as it should. Well, sorry, not the governments necessarily of the West, but a popular movement of people responding and being at our best.
Absolutely at our best. And you know, going back, we went back about 18 months later after the Live Aid. I went back with Bob, and we travelled down from Ethiopia to Mozambique. There was still a civil war going on in Mozambique, but we went back to Ethiopia. We drove to one of the areas, a valley where one of the worst camps was, and I remember getting out. We got out of the Land Rovers, and we looked down on this valley, and there was one hut that they kept as a memorial, and the entire hill and valley was covered in young saplings. And we said to the chap who came up to sort of greet us, who was the caretaker of the place, "What are all these trees?" And he said, "Everyone is planted for a person, a baby, a grandfather, a grandmother, a mother who dies here in this valley." And that was the memory I'll always keep from that trip to Ethiopia. And we stood on the Band-Aid Dam, you know, and we looked down at the irrigation and the fertile land suddenly that was around that area. And, you know, it put to anyone that was doubting that Band-Aid was futile or didn't do the right thing, they should go and stand on that dam and they'd realise, hello, it did do the world of good.
Do you know, one of the other things that's really changed since then is there's absolutely no way in 2025 that a single television report like Michael Burke's or a single image of famine-stricken Ethiopia like those that you created would have the impact to mobilise the world as comprehensively as those did. at that time. Or am I wrong? Do you think that those images can still be created? Is that why you keep on working?
I think it is a very different world. We're bombarded with images all the time that are horrific. I mean, we're looking at Gaza constantly with terrible, terrible images. And in a way, I think we get anaesthetized to it, you know. I don't, because I've been back there and I've seen those things, and they don't leave you. But I think it's very difficult in the modern world with social media as it is, the preoccupation with everything on social media. I think you're right. I think it would be very difficult to move people in the same way. And it's the problem, I think, say, the Children Fund, Oxfam, Medicine Sans Frontières, they all have the same problems raising funds. But we mustn't allow that to be the case. We've got to at least, I think, try. I mean, Band-Aid is still operating in, I think, four or five territories in Africa. Unfortunately, we don't learn by history, and the need is still there in many ways.
There's one thing I have to ask you before I let you go. I'm absolutely fascinated by you jumping between these high art, very glossy celeb photos, which are the covers of many albums, and then going and doing that kind of work in Ethiopia. How did you manage over the course of your career to keep straddling those two very different worlds?
No, I think it's simple. I only ever wanted to be a photojournalist, so I started off only with that goal in mind. And I spent a lot of time covering the troubles in Ireland, in and out of Ireland for 2 years, Vietnam, the Palestinian camps, all of that stuff. That was all I ever wanted to do. And I came back from Vietnam in 1975, a couple of days before it fell. I came out to Paris. And I became very disillusioned with it all, and I was being offered other things. And within 2 years, I was offered a photograph of a pop princess from New York. I had no idea who Debbie Harry was, but she walked into the studio, and that changed everything. I so enjoyed the session and loved meeting Debbie. And, of course, the music business was exploding in the UK and America, and the timing was right for me to move over into that area. I always said I would go back. You know, I said it for years. I'll go back, and I'll go back to photojournalism. I didn't go back until I went with Bob to Ethiopia and Mozambique.
Okay. Debbie Harry walks into the room. You must say to yourself, well, first of all, my God, those cheekbones. And secondly, you must say to yourself, how could I possibly go wrong photographing this face?
Oh, you can go wrong, believe me.
But again, the images, please, anybody, just go and look at Brian Harris's website. Those are exactly the images that you associate with Debbie Harry. Whatever it is that you did absolutely right, because you know, your pictures are the ones that you associate with those people.
Well, thank you.
Hang on a second there, Brian. Deborah, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
You were 14 that day, that hot summer in 1985.
I was indeed, and I remember it like it was yesterday.
And you kept a scrapbook?
Kept a scrapbook, yeah. I started the scrapbook with Band-Aid, and then when Live Aid was announced, I kept a scrapbook then of all the paper cuttings.
Okay, now we'll just sort of gently gloss over whether you owe Brian Harris any royalties for the images that you have kept in this scrapbook. And tell me, what's the standout image, the thing that you have kept there that has the fondest memory, Deborah?
Well, I was saying there to your assistant that it was Freddie Mercury and then Phil Collins, because he went on the Concorde and arrived then in I think it was California.
Performed in Philadelphia and performed in London as well before that, earlier on in the day.
Yeah. So it was Collins makes a double triumph, you know.
Yeah, it might have been the moment that the world decided that's just about enough Phil Collins, really, isn't it? Both sides of the Atlantic in the same day.
Yeah, but it was just like, it was unheard of. Like, you know, 1985, gosh, it was unreal. I just wanted to be one of those girls in the bikini in the crowd.
It was a hot day, wasn't it? Brian Harris, Deborah's outstanding moment, Freddie Mercury, and that's the one that you missed.
I missed that performance. I did. I missed most of them because I was backstage working away with the artists on a one-to-one basis in the studio.
I know, it's funny, isn't it? A witness to history, but facing the wrong way at the time.
Yeah, fabulous. I'm going to use that line, Philip, if I may.
Please feel free. Brian Harris, thank you very much. Continued success and congratulations 40 years
thank
on
you.
From the weekend of the Live 8 performances in Wembley Arena. And Deborah, thank you so much as well for calling in. Take a break.
Thanks, Philip.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
We had an idea in the Liveline office yesterday, which was inspired by watching Iga Świątek come onto centre court at Wimbledon. The big headphones on and obviously in the zone. This was a person who was fully focused, fully charged, sucking diesel and absolutely had all of her Weetabix, and the music was playing a full big part in it because she went on to a 6-2, 6-love victory. And it prompted so many people, Martina Navratilova included, to ask this one question that she was asked after the match in her post-match interview.
Now, as you walk onto court, you're often listening to music. What was the music that got you in the mood today?
Same as every time. I like to keep my routines. So there's some AC/DC, Guns N' Roses, Led Zeppelin, so the Rolling Stones.
24-year-old Iga Świątek making dad rock cool again. Thank you very much, Iga. Good afternoon, Letty. How are you?
I'm all good. How are you?
Excellent. So, do you have a hype song when you need to pull out that 10th chin up or run up that hill? What's your go-to song?
It would be Engine 45 by The Ghost Inside.
Engine 45 by The Ghost Inside, which I'm afraid I have to admit I hadn't heard until today. Why Engine 45?
Well, the band obviously is a big inspiration, but even before that, I love the song because the chorus says, "If it's a war you came to see, you will never see a waved white flag in front of me," which means I'll never give up. You know, it'll give you the motivation to keep going.
Now, before we listen to Engine 45, I have to caution, if anybody is going to go and search for this as a potential new hype song, don't get the numbers 4 and 5 mixed up and the wrong way round, because there is a song called Engine 54.
Yes, there is. I think that's all.
And whatever that song is, it is not a hype song. But Engine 45, Ghost Inside, let us just treat everybody to your metalcore band of choice. Now, Letty, can I ask a very dad question?
Yeah, go for it.
How do you figure out what the lyrics are?
Well, your man Jonathan Vigil, he's actually one of the more understandable ones. Like, some of them sound like water going down a drain.
Well, he still sounds like a hairdryer on full blast. To me, anyway.
Well, what I do is I listen to the song first and then try and make out most of the lyrics, and then I'll listen to it along with the lyrics and then be able to figure out what he's saying.
Ah, good. Okay, I don't feel quite so old now. So you don't automatically understand what he's saying the first time you hear that song?
Not all of them, no. Some of them will be like, oh, I maybe know what that word is. Then I'll look it up and be like, that wasn't the word I was thinking of.
And the lyrics are, I mean, I could see why this would absolutely get you amped. As you say, if it's a war you came to see, you'll never see a waved white flag in front of me. Are they all like that?
Well, you see, like, they're one of the more positive bands. They were involved in a really bad crash in 2019, I think it was, where they were in a head-on collision with a truck. And the driver of their tour bus and the driver of the truck died, and the drummer got his leg amputated. So when they were down, like, in the dumps, like, the fans kept him going, and they dedicated their album, when they were all healthy, back to the fans, like.
And when you listen to that, what do you feel? Just a little bit buoyed up, a little bit positive, or are you ready to go out there and conquer the world?
I'm ready to go out and conquer the world. If anyone's in my way while I'm listening to it on my headphones, stand out.
Watch out, get out of Letty's way.
Exactly.
Your other one is just maybe a little bit more mainstream. You'd be likely to hear it in a gym. What is it?
Yeah, that's probably the most mainstream one I like.
Oh, no, but you have another one. You had another suggestion, an Avicii number.
Yes, it was that one.
Which was?
Levels.
Oh, sometimes I get a good feeling, yeah. Get a feeling that I never, 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 never had before.
Letty, are these everyday go-to songs or special occasion go-to songs?
Whenever they pop up, they're ones that I don't skip. Like if they come on shuffle, I listen to them on an MP3 player.
Okay.
So if they come on, I don't skip them.
But you don't have a morning get out of bed ritual, which is absolutely at the centre of it is Engine 45.
No, like when I go on my bike rides and stuff, I'd listen to them because like they might be the last push I need to get up that hill or something.
All right, Letty, stay there. Ger Prendergast, good afternoon. How are you? Ger, are you there? Can you hear me? Obviously not. He's off listening to his song. Stephen Crowe, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good, Philip. How are you?
What was your song?
It depends on the occasion. So I tend to do a marathon every year. I tend to do the Dublin Marathon. I've done it for the last, I don't know, 15 years or something like that. And they're the kind of things where at the start you feel very happy, you're excited about it, but you're a little bit nervous and you kind of need something to settle you a bit. So as the race starts at the beginning, One Day Like This by Elbow tends to be one that kind of settles you and really gets you into the marathon.
Perfect song for this day, whether you're running a marathon or sitting in an armchair or a deck chair for the day. You could not have chosen a better piece of music more appropriate to the day that's in it. Stephen, do you not end up associating something like that with the impending 3 hours of pain at the start of a marathon?
You can do. You tend not to listen to it much outside of that, to be honest. But look, it's worth it. It's such a beautiful song in itself, and it really, really gets you into the race to start.
My colleague Anne-Marie was saying today, she's a runner as well, that she can't listen to music because that ends up breaking up the run into 3.5 minutes, and she knows exactly how many more songs to go, and her brain is working overtime and doing the maths. So she listens to it. This is just absolutely bizarre. She listens to podcasts instead. You find, though, on the contrary, that breaking it up like that and pacing yourself with music works.
It does. Now, in training runs, I would actually listen to podcasts. I'm not a huge fan of listening to music because you're doing it at a lower pace. You can concentrate on it. It's actually a nice thing to do, just kind of take your mind off the drudgery of training. But in the actual race itself, I need something something to kind of push me on while I'm going, especially something a little bit more up-tempo, which I tend to have a lot of stuff in there as well.
Yeah,
like
I mean, something to just get you over that hill. So do you organise things so that the beat gets faster towards the end of the playlist?
Kind of. The middle of it tends to be like that. Generally, I have it set up. I usually finish the race in around about the same time most years. And I tend to have it set up so that at the very end, where while you're surrounded by thousands of people and it's a very collective event, it can be a slightly lonely place because you're on your own and you're running along and you're in pain and you just kind of want it to be over towards the end and you're running out of energy. So actually, there's a song that I tend to like towards the end of the race setup, which is a song called All My Friends by LCD Sound System, which was out in the mid-2000s. It was we were in our mid-20s. It was accompanied a lot of nights out and a lot of friends get-togethers, and it's something where you kind of feel as if you're getting a little bit of a hug from your friends right at the end of the race.
Well, what if it finishes and you still got another 5 minutes to go?
Actually, look, if you get through it.
All right, stay there. Ger Prendergast, you're back with me. How are you doing?
Hey, how's it going?
You're an endurance runner as well, and your piece of music, it's not the most initially obvious choice of music. Tell me what it is.
Yeah, so I listen to a lot of music by Hans Zimmer and stuff like, you know, the theme tune from Last of the Mohicans, because it's quite, you know, emotional based, as opposed to, you know, other songs that would, you know, people talking there about the tempo of songs and stuff. So if you were to listen to, you know, a song and the tempo is quite high, it can, you know, make you run a bit faster. Sometimes you don't need, you know, you don't want that, like, because, you know, if you're in the middle of a marathon and a high-paced song would come on, you're burning all your energy off, you know, that way.
So it's more about finding something to mentally keep you going.
Or something.
I totally get the Hans Zimmer thing, because in the music, in the movie, rather, of my life, yet to be made, the one where I save the world repeatedly, there is going to have to be a Hans Zimmer score. Nobody else will do, I'm afraid.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the piece, well, we'll play a little bit of the piece of the music from The Last of the Mohicans, because I think most people, even though it's an old movie at this stage, most people will know it. From the point in the movie where he's running to save Madeleine Stowe, and we were actually going to use that in a documentary that I was making a long time ago, until somebody pointed out that the mismatch between me on screen and Daniel Day-Lewis in his prime was just absolutely ridiculous. So we couldn't use it.
It's incredible music, yeah. I used it actually at an event called Deca UK. It was like a 38K swim, 1,800K bike, and then finished with a 420K run. So during that run, I was just like in a heap, as you can imagine. So when I put that music on, the emotional lift I got, you know, got me through that kind of low point in the race. So it's amazing music.
Does the effect of this music ever begin to wear off, Ger?
No, not that song anyway. And there's another couple from Hans Zimmer, like from the Batman movies as well. I think it's called Epictetus. No, it doesn't seem to. Like, as well, I wouldn't be listening to it every day. It's kind of go-to when you need it. Like, I wouldn't listen to music when I'm out training generally. It's more when I'm on the indoor bike, because, you know, I wouldn't listen to music on an outdoor bike. It's just a bit dangerous. And with running as well, you want to be really focused on what's happening inside with your breathing and everything else and your focus. So I don't use music for training generally.
Use sparingly so that it doesn't lose its impact. Or
very
its
much
effect.
So, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Chair, stay there. Katie, good afternoon. How are you?
All good, how are you?
Excellent. So what do you use to get yourself fully charged?
So I'm a coach at the minute. I used to play football, but I definitely listening to music always gets us pumped up before a game.
So you play it to the whole team in the dressing room?
Yeah, absolutely.
And to younger minds as well, who might have slightly different musical tastes to your own, Katie, is there a generational gap there that's easy to overcome?
Yeah, there's not too much, I suppose. I'm 25 now, so the kids that I coached last year were under 12s, but funny enough, there's kind of a couple of the same songs still around, even for the younger girls that we used to listen to when we were younger, funny enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's one of the interesting things about Spotify is that people are listening to music from so many decades ago and treating it as if it is bang up to date. So, come on, what's the song that works then?
So, Lose Yourself would definitely be the number one for Matt.
Of course. Well, here we go, just in case anybody's ever forgotten how effective it is.
Look. If you had one shot, one opportunity to seize everything you ever wanted, one moment that you captured, just let it slip. Yo. His palms are sweaty, knees weak, arms are heavy. There's vomit on his sweater already. Mom's spaghetti, he's nervous, but on the surface he looks calm and ready to drop bombs. But he keeps on forgetting what he wrote down. The whole crowd goes so loud, he opens his mouth, but the words won't come out. He's choking how? Everybody's choking now. The clock's run out, time's up, over, plow. Snap back to reality, oh, there goes gravity. Oh, there goes rabbit, he choked. He's so mad, but he won't give up. No, he won't have it, he knows. His whole back's at his ropes. It don't matter, he's dope. He knows that, but he's pro. He's so stagnant, he knows. When he goes back to this mobile home, that's when it's back to the lab again, yo. This old rhapsody better go capture this moment and hope it don't do it. Lose his health in the music the moment you own it. You better never let it go.
So do you end up with a dressing room full of amped up, juiced up 12-year-olds as a consequence of that?
Yeah, funny enough, that's usually the way it works. It obviously motivates them, it gets them all in the right mindset for a game. And obviously, if it's a knockout game, like, so if you're talking quarterfinal, semi-final, like, you're talking about putting everything on the line, and it just gets everybody hyped, like.
I'd have been telling a group of 12-year-olds they've only got one shot.
I suppose it's a little bit of motivation as well. It doesn't always work, but... because somebody has to lose as well.
What do you play to them when they do lose? What are your words of consolation?
If there's no music, if they lose, definitely not. Everybody is kind of, you know, all down in the dumps after a loss anyway. Look, someone has to lose, I suppose. But definitely Lose Yourself is kind of gets, like, everybody hyped, like the lyrics in it and stuff.
I have to say... as a parent, on those journeys home in the car from the other side of the county after you have lost, when you know it's going to be a long and lonely car ride, Spotify is actually, oh my God, your best friend and your best parenting assistant in those moments. Okay, Katie, thank you very much. Clodagh, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm not too bad.
So tell us, what's your song of choice and why?
My song of choice definitely is Chiquitita by ABBA.
Chiquitita by ABBA. Now, that is not something I had on my bingo card.
Yeah. Luckily, this year I was playing with Galway football, so that obviously means commitment and training. So doing my leaving, I had to miss a good bit of study time. So often I'd stay home early from school. So I'd be on my way to school and then I'd just blare that in the car on the way. And yeah, got me in a good mood, definitely. Okay. Set me up for the day.
Do you listen to music while you study as well?
No, I don't listen to it while I study. It distracts me too much. I'd be listening to the music. I wouldn't be absorbing any information, that's for a fact.
Okay. And in the car then, it works. I'm wondering, who's driving the car?
Myself.
Is it?
Just me.
just you, yourself. And but Chiquitita, sorry. Look, I mean, the reason I'm asking this is my uncertain memory is that's 1979. And if you've done your Leaving Cert, you were born in 2007, 2008?
Yeah, 2007, correct.
Okay, so there's, you know, two lifetimes in between the release of that song and you actually being born, and yet somehow it ends up being your go-to number.
I know, yeah. I mean, you can't beat the old ones, that's for sure. ABBA are a classic.
No, you can't. Well, let's remind ourselves why. Chiquitita, you and I. Are you working? Are you raring? Are you on fire?
I am.
Are you sucking diesel there, Clodagh?
I am, in fact. Grateful to you now.
Okay. I have to say, ABBA has never done that for me. Is there anybody else out there for whom ABBA is their go-to choice of music? Their juiced music, their amp music, their get the full five bars? Or as I'm going to get banned now or cancelled by all of the Gen Zs when they say, what is it? The phrase I'm not allowed to use. Oh yes, this song is so hyped. What's the hyped song? The hyped ABBA song of choice, Clodagh? Have you any other ones?
Probably "Bright Side of the Road" Van Morrison. That's a good one. Starts off fast instantly, so it gets me going.
Do you know that there's been plenty of great music composed since 2007 when you were born?
I know, but I have to. It's the recommendations from my dad. I'm keeping alive, definitely. He's on the way to training Spotify, as you said, their best friend.
Okay, so it's your dad's choices are shaping your own.
Yep, definitely. Okay. It's a big influence.
All right, take care. We'll give you a reprise of Chiquitita into the ad break. Thanks very much, Clodagh. Chiquitita, you and I.
Line on RTE Radio 1 0818 715 815.
Rachel Teodoro, good afternoon. You've gone viral.
I have, yes.
Very, very viral. You're back in Seattle now, but just a couple of days ago you were in Cove and you went for a walk. What happened?
Well, I was looking for that classic shot of the deck of cards houses with the church in the background, and had received some information that if you go down the Spy Hill street there, that you could prop your phone up on a high up fence and take a photo and just kind of snap something. But while we were walking, we ended up on someone's private home, and there was a sign there that said, come on in, you can donate €2 to my Ferrari fund and you get an even better shot from my backyard. And so we did that instead.
And is it a better shot?
I don't know if it's a better shot. It is unobstructed. It is easier to get. You don't have to do tippy-toe stance on your feet to get up there. And I think it's worth the €2 just to pay some cheeky guy a little bit of money for his Ferrari fund.
I think it's a better shot because not only do you get the deck of cards and you get the full church in the background, you also get a bit of the sea. And we're very used in this country to the deck of cards shot and exactly the same angle all the time. But the image that you got, very new, very novel, and really very appealing.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. So there you go. It was worth it. And I'm getting to talk to you from Seattle in Ireland on a random Friday.
Well, I can do better than that, because the cheeky chappy or cheeky guy with his sign, "Dear tourists, this is my private garden. Please take photos. And if you can, please donate €2, as my son wants a Ferrari." He is on the line. Magic, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
How are you?
Very good, very good. On the sunny day in Ireland.
Very good. And Magic, when did the idea hit you that you could use the garden in this way?
I bought a house 3 years ago, and when we were renovating the house, I came to the house and I could see a small Portuguese girl behind the gate, and I said, "What are you doing there?" "I'm just taking the photo." So she did climb over the fence, over the wall, into the property to take the picture. And when we came back with my son from work one Saturday, there was a group of people standing behind the gate and asking us to let them in. And my son charged them a few euro, and they were very happy to pay for it. But the main thing is, you see, I can't stop it. When I bought the house, I didn't know about it. Like most of the local people don't know that it's so many tourists coming to take the picture. But when I bought it, and my dog moved in, my dog got very aggressive because people were sitting on the wall and some of them were even jumping into the property.
Well, of course, it's his territory. Why wouldn't he take that attitude? But yeah. Magic, when you bought the place, you must have in part bought it for the view.
Oh, no, yeah. I'm Polish. I'm living in Cove for the last 20 years. And I bought it for the view, but I didn't know about the tourists.
Okay, okay.
And Joanna Murphy was the lady who sold me the house. I'm very happy she did. I'm very delighted with the house. I'm living in it for the last 2 years. It's still under construction, renovation and extension, but it's a very nice spot, as you know.
Beautiful spot. How many people a day are coming and taking photos and giving you €2 now?
Okay, not too many are giving the €2, but how many are coming? Between 50 and probably 200 on the Saturday, Sunday.
Okay, so how far away are you from getting a Ferrari? For your son, of course, sorry. How far away?
Far away.
And tell me, will your son be legally able to drive the Ferrari when you do get it? Or might you have to drive it for him, Magic?
Okay, I have two sons, and one of them, yes, he could, because he's got a driving license and he has the car already. And the second one, before we collect the money, I think the second one will be able to drive it as well. It will take a while. I think he's going to be my age or more than before we get it.
Okay. And how badly do they want the Ferrari?
Oh, no, it's for the fun, really. It's just the... to make people laugh. It's not about the Ferrari, of course. It's like, well, I can't stop it. Like I said, people were sitting, jumping on the wall. My younger son asked me to put the jars that he's collecting for the computer, but I think it would be not that much fun. You know, for Ferrari sounds better.
Do you mind losing your privacy, Magic?
Losing my privacy?
Yeah.
No.
Not a problem to you. Are you a chatty kind of person? Do you enjoy meeting all of these strangers?
Yes. I'm not a shy person, no.
No, you don't sound like it. Rachel, are you still there with us, Rachel?
I'm still here, yes.
Okay. How widely viewed has this video been now? I'm just wondering how many more people Magic is likely to have to make way for in the coming days.
It's closing in on 500,000 views.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's big news, isn't it? That's
yes. So I believe there's a few people who have bookmarked this, and they're going to head towards Magic to enjoy his property as well. And I will say that we appreciate that he has opened up his lawn for this purpose, so that other people can enjoy it as well.
All right. Thank you both very much, Rachel Teodoro in Washington and Magic in Cove. Take care. It's lovely to talk to you this afternoon. Martin Coughlin, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm all right, but can I just comment a little bit on that last piece? Very, very interesting. Raises the question as to whether or not farmers should be paid some modicum of a fee for the maintenance of the countryside and the use of right-of-ways and all that through their property.
We should all be paying them for the nature restoration and the nature maintenance that they do when they do it, absolutely.
Which is all of the time, because that is just the way farmers are. Anyway, that is not why you...
That is not what we want to talk about. We want to talk about, of all of the things under the sun that we could talk about today, you want to talk about banana ice cream.
Well, your researcher was interested in it anyway. That was absolutely sure. Banana ice cream, for those of us who like it, we have noticed that it has disappeared from our supermarkets and shops. Probably, I'm not entirely sure how long ago, but at least a year ago. I contacted HB Hazelbrook Farm, and they informed me that they no longer make banana ice cream, and that they only made it exclusively for the Irish market. Even though they are a British company, they never released it onto the British market.
What is it about it that's so appealing?
It's just nice. It may have something to do with the fact that, I'm sure as a lot of people know, the Irish nation, as a nation per head of population, we consume quite a lot of bananas, 11 kilos, I think, per year, per person. Now, obviously, not everybody eats them, so those of us who are probably eating a little bit more. So it probably passes on from that in some respects. Just it's a question of taste, I'm sure.
Yeah, but, you know, for fans of bananas, banana ice cream wouldn't be your first port of call necessarily, would it?
Well, it wouldn't, but in the warm weather, it would be quite nice. Like, we all like our banana sandwiches and whatever, and eating your raw bananas, good for you, it's got lots of vitamins and all that sort of stuff.
Lots of potassium, yeah.
Yeah, lots of potassium and that. But how would I say... Vanilla ice cream is lovely. You can get different flavours of vanilla, and it is a matter of personal taste. I just happen to like banana ice cream, as does my wife, as do a number of other people I know. And this, it was one of those things that I'm maybe a little bit quirky. I said, I must look into this to see why. It may have something to do with the fact that I do a bit of news reporting as well, but that's on a different subject.
Martin, I suspect that what might have happened here is that... time and tastes moved on, because, you know, you can't buy vanilla ice cream anywhere. You can, but you're more likely to be able to buy Zanzibari and vanilla pod ice cream rather than straightforward vanilla ice cream. And maybe banana ice cream was just a little bit kind of dated in that world of more modern tastes.
Well, possibly. Maybe I come from a certain generation, having been born in the 60s, brought up in the 70s, and that it's like it was a luxury, to be perfectly honest about it. And banana ice cream was kind of maybe possibly the top of the tree at the time as far as exoticness is concerned, with all due respect to your Zanzibar ice cream.
I know. Imagine trying to tell that to any Gen A or Gen Z now, that your little block of banana ice cream between two wafers was actually not just the pinnacle, it was the very tippy top, the apex of luxury.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, my wife tells a story of when she came back from England in the 1980s. She went into a particular very well-known supermarket and asked whether or not they had garlic bread, right? And she was told, she tells this story, she said, we'd probably have it in a week, maybe 10 days. It wasn't always. We were, once upon a time, we really were a case of meat and two veg, and that was about as exotic as it got.
And deferred, you know, gratification, now, absolutely.
Yeah, now just, I mentioned to your researcher as well that a thing that has kind of died a death to some degree, but again will resonate with a certain generation, is what we call down here, where I'm in County Waterford, the float, which is basically a combination of, we use red lemonade and vanilla ice cream. Your researcher said, oh God, I remember that.
Yeah.
You used to use orange, club orange or Fanta.
When did that fade from popularity?
I don't know. I don't know, but I remember getting one there, was it last year, and the lady in the shop had no idea. Now, she was quite a young lady, she's probably no more than 19 or 20, had no idea what I was at, because I actually got a coffee cup, small bottle of red lemonade, da-da-da-da, and dunked me ice cream into it.
For the benefit of people under the age of 35 who may not have got to experience
this, you have to go out and try this. They have to go out and try this.
You drop scoop of the ice cream into your soft drink, and not only is it a wonder of haute cuisine, it's also a mystery of chemistry as you see these two things interact with each other. Now, I know that the modern expression of it is probably putting the Mentos into the bottle of Coke and watching it rocket off into the air.
No. What you would do here is if you could get yourself a pint glass, or a large glass, and cut your slice of ice cream. Be it vanilla is probably the best. Okay, well, it's the only one I ever tried. I never tried it with banana ice cream for some reason. I don't know why.
Too late now.
And you get your red lemonade or your club orange or whatever it is, and you pour that in. And the immediate thing that actually happens is the whole thing froths up immensely, Half your glass will be in froth, so you can kind of lick that off or do whatever is necessary.
And you're not exaggerating, Martin, because your initial reaction is to take a step back from the table.
Yeah, it is. This thing could explode at any minute. You know, sort of this table self-destruct and all that sort of thing. Again, another reference to the
1970s. Wear eyeglasses before trying this at home, children.
But it's the coldness of it that is so brilliant. You know, you've got the liquid in it and you have the coldness of the ice cream that comes through in whatever you've mixed it with. You can eat it with a spoon, you can suck it with a straw, you can, you know, do all that sort of thing. And it's filling and it's refreshing and, you know, it's a treat.
It was also very, very tasty as well, wasn't it? Do you know
something, Mark? Loaded. Yeah.
The thing that's kind of dangerous about all of this is that the further down this path of nostalgia we slip, well, the more kind of Brexity you end up becoming in your thinking. Maybe it is incumbent upon people of a certain age like you and me to just say, okay, banana ice cream, that's another thing that's gone and has been replaced by Zanzibarian vanilla pod ice cream or whatever it is. And that's just progress.
Is it progress, or are you just limiting people's choices in some respects? We have endless amounts of teas, endless amounts of coffees and all the rest of it. But the Irish people do like their own food and their own drinks, right? And it isn't all about Zanzibarian beer or Zanzibarian ice cream. We should probably appreciate the fact that in this country we have great companies that produce fantastic foods and have done for generations. And, you know, occasionally, like, you get up in the morning, like, you put your marmalade on your toast and you probably never think, like, where did that come from? It's Irish, in all possibility.
We have a statement from HB which does not close the door to the possible return of banana ice cream. Now, it doesn't fling it wide open either, but it doesn't close it completely. We are constantly listening to our customers and exploring new ideas to bring exciting ice cream innovations to the market. And, listen up, Martin, even bringing back some old favourites from time to time. And we hope to delight you with more of these in the future.
Actually, I think I didn't mention it earlier, when I did contact them and I spoke to a very nice gentleman over there, he did inform me I wasn't the first Irish person to ring up to inquire as to what happened to my banana ice cream.
Okay.
You know, it is what it is. But again, you can get a certain level of sophistication into all your foods and all the rest of it. But at the end of the day, as I said earlier, like, there's something to be said for, your more traditional type of food, your more traditional type of drink, your more traditional type of whatever.
Oh, hang on a second, Martin. I've got your sister on line one. Sandra, good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, Philip. Not too bad. How are you?
What did you want to say to Martin?
I tell you, I can give up looking for the banana ice cream because I have been obsessed for years. Every time I go into any supermarket, I've asked my daughters to even look out for it if they ever see it. Just buy it for me, the banana ice cream. But now that I know at least it's not available, so I will stop looking.
Are you kidding me? So, sorry, was this top of every shopping list?
Oh, absolutely. Every time, just straight to the ice cream to see if there's any banana.
Milk, bread, fruit, veg, meat, all down below banana ice cream up at the top, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. Every time and twice on Sundays. I'm the same with the other
things. Come here.
Have you spent the ice cream.
Have you spent too long out in the sun today now, Sandra?
Probably, Philip. Yeah, probably. It's the heat, actually.
Okay.
Not even the sun.
So was it red lemonade or was
it
had to be red lemonade, did it?
Oh, no. It had to be red lemonade and just plain vanilla ice cream. Now, that was my Saturday night treat with my nana, my grandmother. And at that time, I tell you, Philip, I'm going that far back to Gay Byrne was on the Late Late on a Saturday night, if you remember, originally.
Mm-hmm.
And I stayed with my nana. And my treat was sitting in front of the old fire, and I had my red lemonade and my big dollop of ice cream, and I used to sit there and swirl it around and be melting it, and there was nothing like it. So the memories that that brings back to me, when that gentleman said that, I couldn't believe it, because the memories I have of my nana, I often say, tell my daughters about it. All I used to look forward to was sitting in front of the fire with my red TK red lemonade and my ice cream.
Except no substitute, Sandra. It has to be HB banana ice cream. It has to be TK red lemonade. No imposters will do.
That's exactly, Philip. You have it in one. Absolutely. All right. Nothing else. But now I'm actually relieved. I can't believe that it's come up.
See, Martin?
I'm so obsessed with it. Now I know I won't look anymore.
Valuable public service you have provided here today, Martin. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. I won't have to be in that freezer section, frozen, going through every brand and every flavour of ice cream to try. I even root through them. You know, that brand, I root through them to see in case of some of the back.
I have an image in my mind of you disappearing, legs up into the air, flinging blocks of ice cream out behind you, searching for the banana ice cream.
That is me, Philip. You're not far wrong. Yeah, that would be me.
Don't encourage her. Don't encourage her.
Oh, yeah, I do, because I'm not that... I'm quite small. Well, I am very small, 5 foot. And so I do have to do that. So you're not wrong, Philip. I actually do that down to the bottom.
You could be lost in the frozen food aisle forever, Sandra.
Sandra, can I ask you...
Philip.
Go on, Martin.
Yeah, Sandra, can I ask you another question? Because we're probably similar vintages as such, right?
Of course.
Do you remember old-time Irish fruit fields marmalade?
Oh, God, yes.
And you remember the label that used to be on it? It had a traditional, very traditional old Irish fire, big open kind of farm.
It had a cat on it, didn't it?
And it had a cat on it as well. And did you notice there a number of years ago, they got rid of that label and they changed it to what I consider to be rather a bland label, because it's no longer a distinguishing Irish feature, like the cat in front of the fire, as my brother used to say. He christened it Pussycat Jam. But it was uniquely, the label itself was uniquely Irish. It could resonate with anybody who lived in Ireland. Now they've gone to something that is rather pastel, and it wouldn't be overly, I'm not overly gone on the label, like, not saying anything.
No, you're 100% right, because it was easier even to pick out when you were looking at them.
I'm so glad that I've introduced the two of you to each other. So I think I'm going to go and take a commercial break, and I'm going to leave the two of you to just chat about all the old times and get all misty-eyed and reminiscent about food of yesteryear.
The point, Mr. Hayes, what I raised about the marmalade is it was a uniquely Irish label was on a uniquely Irish product, which has now been blended into the background.
All right, with Martin, the new labelling. Thank you very much, and thank you as well, Sandra. Let's take a break.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Some people have summer hype songs so that they can bench press their own weight. Some people have summer hype songs so they can sit in the car park outside work and rock out so that they can fake it till they make it ahead of that key presentation. Trish, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to you. You have a summer hype song to get you through the ironing.
I have indeed. I like Sinead O'Connor. I think she hits it right on the nail when I'm feeling a little bit under the weather and a little bit tired.
So is the ironing a drudgery, or is there anything therapeutic about it all when you're listening to music?
very therapeutic. I run a very small B&B in Galway City. So after a morning of departing guests and pulling bedrooms apart and putting them back together again, and booking people in, showing them maps of the city, deciding where to go, where not to go, then the ironing starts, so I'd be prepared for the next day. And that's my meditation time.
Hang on a second. I have a sneaking suspicion you're ironing bed sheets for your Airbnb guests, are you?
Well, it's not Airbnb. That's enough an insult, but yes, that's what I'm doing.
Sorry.
And it is sheets, pillow slips, duvet covers.
Excuse me saying Airbnb. Yes. I don't know why I said it. B&B, people. Philip.
B&B.
Yeah. But you're ironing bed sheets.
Yes.
Oh, Trish, never was there a more criminal waste of human labour.
Sometimes I think that, but other times it's kind of downtime. You sit with this ironing machine. It's a roller iron machine. It's 26 years old. It hasn't let me down yet.
Really?
It does a little bit of coughing and spluttering every now and again, but it's still working. I have my radio on or my music on, looking at a blank TV screen, and I'm feeding this machine. Yeah.
Okay.
And Sinead O'Connor, Prince, or believe it or believe it not, Johnny gets me the evening.
Sorry, you broke up there after Prince. What was the third one?
Or even the one which nobody of my family will listen to is Johnny Cash.
Why would nobody listen to Johnny Cash in your family?
Well,
damn their eyes, Trish.
I've got kids who are all, you know, in the 20s mark, and Johnny Cash is just a dinosaur as far as.
Oh, have you tried them out on the last three albums, the American collection?
No. As soon as I turn it on in the car, all of a sudden they start to interfere with the controls.
Oh.
Yeah.
It's not too late to put them up for adoption, Trish.
Well, at the moment, because it's the summer, they class themselves as mommy slaves now.
Well,
they have to take their turn.
You tell them from me, my heart bleeds for them. So, which Sinead O'Connor song is it?
Nothing Compares. Yeah, and it's kind of me tapping myself on the back, you know, when I play that.
Well, I wish I had some Johnny Cash to hand. I don't, because I would play it just to spite your children. But here is Sinead O'Connor, Nothing Compares. Sinead O'Connor is my go-to song as well, but that's my least favourite song of hers.
Oh, well, you see, I kind of put myself in the spotlight there, and I say how fantastic I am. That's what I'm singing that to myself.
How long does that work for?
As long as the ironing continues, but I have it down to a fine art now, so we're getting there. We're getting there.
Sorry, do you have the song on repeat throughout the ironing, or are you just very quick?
No. I just every as soon as I start, I need to kind of hype myself. So I'm sitting there with my little tin of Monster, my blank TV screen, and I'm feeding the machine. I'm feeding the animal. The weather is so good here in Galway at the moment that I can't do it till late this evening, because otherwise I will pass out.
Ironing in the sun wouldn't be a good idea. I'm beginning to wonder, though, is it the energy drink that's doing the work here, or Sinead O'Connor?
Well, I have a fantastic voice when I start drinking Monster, so...
Really? Okay. All right, Trish. Thank you very much.
Nice talking to you,
Philip. Lovely to get
the
call from you. You too. Have a great day.
Lifeline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815. Everybody, all we hear, radio, radio, radio.
So, Tracy, tell me, 40 years ago this weekend, what were your memories of Live Aid?
Yeah, I was just thinking about it, Philip. It was like just the most amazing experience. You know, it's very hot. As I said to one person I was speaking to, I kind of managed to work my way to the kind of front of the crowd, not at the very front because you couldn't actually see anything. So I was just a little bit back from the stage. And they were spraying us with water to keep us cool. And like, I'm a big Queen fan, you know, so Queen come on and they're just electric, you know. And like you, I heard you play in the intro there, the Radio Gaga. And when that came on and, you know, and then Freddie did the bit where he got the crowd to sing with him. I mean, literally, I'm shaking now, literally thinking about it, because it's just, now I knew that song. Everybody knew the song, you know, and we're just all singing in unison. And he did the most extraordinary things. You know, it is like, you know, it's one of those times in life where you just think, I was actually there, you know, and that's, you can't often say that kind of thing. Like, I just was there, didn't have a ticket, went up. Managed to get a ticket from a man whose daughter sadly was sick. I managed to get in. I joined the people, my sister and her friends who went, you know, and you just kind of were, okay. We were sitting right at the back in the stadium. But it was like electric. I mean,
did you know
else.
That, Tracy, or was it just exciting because you were a big Queen fan and there you were getting to see them? Or did you see that performance on that day at that moment as being something, you know, something different?
Oh, well, they were something different. Now, like going up to, you know, the lead up to it, you know, everyone was talking about it. And then I didn't have a ticket. I went up because somebody was driving. They were quite young and I thought I'd accompany them. So we got in. You don't know what you're going for, really. You have no idea. So I had no idea. And I just, you know, it was very hard to make your way to the front of the stage. But when Queen came on, I think they had like 17 minutes and then they were going to have the plug pulled on them. I think they were very tight. So you just could tell, like, Freddie was absolutely on fire. And the whole crowd, like, it was spectacular. I'm a big Queen fan anyway, but you can see it if you look back at it. They're a standout performance on that show. You know, they really are. But
your picture ended up in one of the teen magazines.
Well, it did. I mean, I can't honestly remember which one it was, but I remember, you know, like when they were taking a picture of the crowd, I was wearing a very bright pink. I was very uncool, you know, really uncool in my Laura Ashley skirt and my bright pink T-shirt. But you could see me.
Sorry, you went to Live Aid in a Laura Ashley skirt.
Yeah, that's me. You know, it's me. Like, you know,
wow,
what I
mean?
That
was a brave choice.
Well, I had no idea. I just go with my leather sandals, which I took off and held in my hand because we got so wet. But no, I didn't know. There were people looking groovy and kind of cool. Like, I wasn't cool. I was just there in my skirt, my purple skirt, my pink T-shirt. So you could actually see me. But I know, looking at the footage, there's somebody else in a bright pink T-shirt. That's not me. They're jumping around. That's not me. But I do look. You could see me in one of those teen magazines. No, I could see the crowd and I could see myself.
Well done.
You know,
okay.
It's just one of those things.
Hang on there. Let me bring in Siobhan. Siobhan, you remember Freddie Mercury performing that day particularly as well.
I sure do, Philip. But
why?
Quite a different context to your other caller. I was in Milton Malbay in Clare at the Willie Clancy Summer School, set dancing. So I was goofing around in the heat of the day in the hall, head full of Kerry set and jigs and reels. And I arrived back to my host family at B&B, and there they were, plugged in front of the telly, watching Freddie Mercury. So it was just like two complete different universes.
And were you there? Did you join them with all the curls and ringlets in the Guna and in front of the telly?
I'm not sure I had the Gouda or the curls and ringlets. I was probably wearing a sloppy old T-shirt and God knows what I had on, but it was just mesmerising. And it still is, thinking about it and watching the reruns on the telly. And radio still loves you, like Freddie was, you know, he was just magic. The whole thing was like beyond, we were transported to some other universe. We were on some other planet.
Do you know how long it is ago since he died, Siobhan? 1991. It's absolutely amazing how.
Yes, he still gets everybody going, and he did that day for sure. He did.
Can you imagine?
Incredible.
Can you imagine asking any other artist to do something as simple as go out there on that stage in front of that stadium crowd and perform some vocal exercises and see how they react?
Well, I suppose he was such a live performer, and I did read that Bob Geldof had told him to keep it very tight. Bob gave him only so many minutes.
Yeah.
And there was even a question whether Queen would be on the stage that day. So
piece of magic.
Oh, well, the whole thing was very, very special memory. 40 years ago this week.
I know. I feel it now. I feel
no, you don't. No, you don't. No, you don't. No, you don't. Deny that. Deny that feeling. Siobhan, thank you very much. That's all that we have time for today. James Feeney was on sound. Research was by Nuala Macklin. Owen McLaughlin produced the series. Producer is Annette Egan.